Welcome, a listener, to another episode of Spam, 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 Humbug, or rather a throwback to two quite old episodes of the podcast. I didn't have time to put together another reading of Through the Moongate this week, nor did I have time to hold another recording session with the podcast crew. So instead, we are diving back into the archives, and what I've done is I've actually spliced together two different episodes from the very beginning of the podcast's run. The main portion of this episode is a discussion about Ultima 5. And it's very obvious that it was the early days of the podcast. The audio is just so insanely rough to listen to now. Some of the participants were not doing anything about their background noise. It was a rough start, definitely. Wow, listening to it again is just makes me glad for the equipment I have now. I'll put it that way. But finishing up the episode is actually an excerpt of the audio from episode 9, which is a little dramatic reading that was put together by Boolean Dragon, with Linguistic Dragon doing most of the voice work. It is about the fall of Astaroth, one of the Shadow Lords, and it is a fantastic little bit of Ultima fanfic in audio form. So, even if the first hour or so of discussion in this episode is a bit rough for you, be sure to catch that. It's a gem. And of course, as always, the podcast is brought to you by our Patreon backers. Thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex. By that means, you can join that crew for yourself at patreon.com/UltimaCodex. And as always, a hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Golden Flame, Dominic, Violation, Helgriff, Gronk, Pascal, and Thorwan. All right, that's enough for me. Let's get on with the show.
So... Ultima 5, Warriors of Destiny, what is it? Well, it's the fifth entry in the Ultima series, obviously. The fifth numbered entry as well. I think it would be sixth if you actually count Mount Drash at all, which I don't know if anyone does, but there it is. What's it about? I mean, it's set many, many years after the quest of the Avatar had completed. The Avatar finds himself drawn back into a very different Britannia, one in which Lord British has gone missing during an expedition to the underworld and left his then close confidant, Lord Blackthorn, in charge. But of course, Blackthorn has become corrupted by the influence of the malevolent Shadow Lords. He's implemented a very he's twisted the virtues, rather, into a very harsh system of laws with which the land is governed. Many of the Avatar's companions have been driven into hiding, sort of like a little bit of a French resistance kind of thing going on there, I guess. And yes, this is the game that the Avatar and the player find themselves thrust into, and it goes from there. So, looking, I guess, a little bit first at the creation and design of Ultima 5, I mentioned the French Revolution there, and I don't know, or the French, sorry, Resistance, World War II. But, you know, what are some of the influences that it seems Origin Systems drew on for inspiration when creating Ultima 5? Who wants first kick at that? I got Sanctimonia waving his hand there a little bit, so go ahead.
Yeah, I'd probably say one of the strongest influences for Ultima 5 was actually its predecessor, Ultima 4. What they did in Ultima 4 was so profound with respect to other role-playing games at the time and the virtues that they wanted to sort of continue, you know, ride the coattails of their previous success, but give it a twist. And, you know, they literally gave it a twist by perverting the virtues.
I guess there is an element of that too, right? I mean, they had just introduced the eight virtues with Ultima 4, and now all of a sudden, here we are, seeing them in Ultima 5 mutated and codified into a series of laws that are, you know, quite reprehensible and horrifying on the face of it. obviously there is sort of a continuation of theme there, And two, I mean, if I recall correct, you know, like you're, you do start to see the virtues kind of being enacted in the world a little bit, right? Because, you know, when you have the Shadow Lord in one of the towns, the people there start acting contrary to the virtue of that town, as I recall. You know, so people will lie to you in Moonglow until the Shadow Lord goes away, and then they'll tell you the truth again. All right, Adam.
I don't think that they actually, I don't think that the coding is precise enough that they're really acting opposite the town's virtue. If the Shadow Lord of Falsehood is there, they will lie. It doesn't matter which town it is. If the Shadow Lord of Cowardice is there, they run away from you, regardless of which town it is, etc.
Yeah, fair enough.
Although it's possible that we need to standardize on one version because it's been ported and I don't know what kinds of changes, so.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, it was the last Ultima really to be ported to a number of different platforms.
Yeah, I think the standard version now that people generally play when they run emulators is the DOS version, IBM PC version. I think it has the best graphics of all the ones that were released.
Yeah,
that's
you may
the one
be
that
right.
I grew up with.
Indeed. and I guess, too, yeah, I mean, Adam, you're right, too, in that, you know, the Shadow Lords, they don't represent, you know, perversions of any particular virtue, nor do they represent, you know, the perversion of virtue in the overarching sense. Like, you know, there are the three Shadow Lords, and they directly oppose the principles more than anything else, right? Truth, love,
that is correct.
So, all right. But, you know, what are some of the other things that people had thrown out here? Someone wrote Tolkien. So who contributed
Absolutely.
The Tolkien suggestion?
Oh, I did. I mean, my goodness. Story-wise, of course, I didn't read Tolkien or read Lord of the Rings anyway until shortly before the films were going to be made. And I realized, oh, I better read this thing. So, having grown up playing Ultima 5, imagine my surprise. I'm reading this like, hey, wait a minute. Wait, Ringwraiths? What? Shadow Lords? There's all of the imagery and those sort of situations just totally lifted from Tolkien, but remixed and reimagined into something new. So, you know, Garriott, he likes to borrow, but he definitely created something interesting there with what Tolkien put out.
Three shards for mortal men doomed to die.
Yes. And you've even got the sort of corrupted king, like King Theoden in Blackthorn.
Yes, albeit I don't think you get to draw him out as poison from a wound
No. So
much.
I just pulled down the official book of Ultima to see what it has to say about sources for things that he stole. And one thing that I had forgotten that's interesting is that this at least asserts... Remember that Ultima 5 is the first one to introduce the language of magic, all of the syllables A to Z that we're used to. This evidently was inspired by Narnia.
Really?
Hmm. Gosh, I read Narnia so darn long ago, and they don't really touch on that in the movies either, so I'm going to have to go back and think how that could be, unless someone's got Narnia like really fresh in mind, because I don't remember.
Yeah, I know the Narnia books like the back of my hand, and I'm... admittedly not quite seeing the connection at the moment.
It's quite simply that there was a language of magic, and he wanted to formalize a language of magic for Ultima Moore, which
I guess
mostly might be like the magician's nephew creation of Narnia.
I'm thinking more along the lines of the stone table in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because when Aslan is explaining the deep magic, I don't remember whether it's him or the White Witch, but one of the two of them explains how it's written in letters as deep as a spear is long on the stone table itself. So, I don't know, maybe that's what he was going for.
Oh, maybe, because, yeah, there is all of those. Yeah, the old inscriptions. Or even just, you know, I mean, the deep magic within Tolkien, or within Lewis's mythos means something a little bit different than just, you know, rote spellcasting. But, I mean, obviously, you know, it introduces the concept of magic as being a thing which is written. And maybe that's part of what goes into it as well. So.
Oh, yeah, and there's also the spell book in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader with a series of spells and I recall a big deal being made about the writing in it. So another potential influence there.
Yeah, that I could see that more. Huh. Well, that's an interesting one. Lewis. What else does it say in there? Does it list anything else in there, Adam?
Oh. No, it's surprisingly brief in real-world influences. It goes on to talk about how they wanted to make the people more like real living people, which is essentially the introduction of the scheduling system, and then it goes on to the trials and tribulations of actually trying to make it and get it out the door on time.
Fair enough. Adric, did you have something you wanted to add there?
Yeah, you know, something that just occurred to me is there's a touch of Journey to the Center of the Earth in following Lord British's footsteps down the waterfall and down into the underworld.
That's true, too. Especially because the underworld is, like, you know, still one of the ultimate dungeon delves.
Yeah, that also reflects one of the mechanics in Ultima 3, where you would actually enter Sosaria by going through a whirlpool in the ocean.
Well, that's right. Yeah, you have to... I remember that. I think at one point I actually stole that for... stole that for when I was still writing the plot for Lost Sosaria, as, you know, like another way of entering the abyss. But, although, wasn't there a way to enter the abyss via whirlpool? Was that in Ultima 5?
Yeah.
In Ultima 5, you could whirlpool and you wound up next to Captain John, or you could go down through the dungeons. In 3,
right,
it was the only way to get to Ambrosia.
Right, that's what it was. Cool.
I'm sorry, I said Sosaria, I meant Ambrosia.
That's all good. Cool. And yeah, I mean, the other influence that was, you know, penciled in within the notes here was Robin Hood, which I guess kind of also does come into it, right? There's a, well, maybe we'll fix it in post, I don't know. But yeah, there is kind of a Robin Hood-esque thing too, because, you know, you are leading your little ragtag band through the wilds of Britannia to undo the damage caused by this corrupt regent, you know, who is left in charge of the land by the good king, who's of course gone off to whatever task he happens to be pursuing. So I can certainly see something there. Oh goodness, well this is now going to be officially more fun to edit in post, because the furnace just decided to kick on. Thank you, furnace, I love you. It's a good thing Audacity has, you know, actually a really decent noise reduction algorithm. Really happy about that. Moving on then, I guess. We mentioned the NPC schedules there just beforehand. So yeah, what were, that does invite the broader question of, you know, what were some of the significant changes in game design, in the design of an Ultima, apparent in Ultima 5, as compared to earlier entries in the series? Who wants to take first stab at that one? Okay, Linguistic, go ahead.
Well, the NPC schedules have already been mentioned, and I had a session of the game yesterday, working on a post about that said session at the moment. But as far as the NPC scheduling goes, it really does bring about a new sense of character to the NPCs, even though there's just little pixelated, blocky characters. The thing that stuck out to me was Stormcrow, I think was the name of it, the lighthouse to the south of Minock. And it's, you know, a married couple that runs it, and you see the wife up in the tower during the daytime and the husband at night. And I remember walking out of the lighthouse just when they're kind of passing the torch, kind of going by each other, and they take the time to eat together before they go their separate ways, and one of them goes to sleep and the other one goes up to the tower, and it just kind of gives a little touch of character to those two people in the lighthouse just by where they go and how they're scheduled in relation to each other as they pass by.
Yeah, that's cute. I admit I actually never saw them have dinner together. So
I think it also had a rather profound effect on the way the player had to force himself to change their behavior. Because when a shopkeeper closed his shop, he would be in his bed. So it really limited the amount of resources that were made available to you based on the time of day. So that would just really dramatically change the way the player was forced to play the game based on the time of day. Not to mention the limited visibility due to the day-night cycles.
Right, and the limited availability of some NPCs that gave out essential clues, like the sleepwalking mage that gives out one of the words of power, who's only up for a couple hours a day.
Right. Or even something basic like food. You know, try and find food at 11 p.m. in Britannia.
And of course, there was nothing quite like attacking someone while they were sleeping in their bed and seeing the text murdered in the log.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a little hard to pass it off as, you know, well, they started it.
Yeah, I was really upset when I attacked Blackthorn in bed and it did not say murdered.
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't work out for me.
Did you kill him by that means?
You could not. I was hoping so much. Instead, I think I probably got killed.
Okay, because I remember with Ultima 6, that was the bug with Lord British. He was otherwise invulnerable, but if you took a glass sword to him while he was in bed, it was, and what had happened there was, you know, to depict all sleeping NPCs, they actually just had, like, one generic NPC, I guess. Something to that effect. They had one generic NPC, and all he did was, you know, he was the sleeping NPC, and everybody who went to sleep, they got sort of transformed into this, I think is about how it worked. Anyways, the point was, he was no longer invulnerable Lord British. The game kind of swapped in this standby for the duration of his sleep and then swapped him back in when he woke up. The end result being that, you know, you could kill him in his bed.
But did you kill him then?
Yeah, because he wouldn't swap back in the morning. Like, he'd be dead. And you could find the stuff on his body. That was the weird thing.
Okay, that's conclusive. So.
I actually think it's a little suspicious that pretty much in every Ultima there was always one way to kill Lord British, despite how much effort apparently Richard Garriott put into preventing people from killing him. I think there may have been something deeper going on, like perhaps the least paid programmer always working it in intentionally as an Easter egg.
Maybe. I mean, a lot of it was, well, certainly with Ultima 6 it was all exploit-based. You know, it was the fact that there was that substitution, right, that happened there that enabled you to do it. By the time of Ultima 7, certainly it had become a running gag. I don't know. Golden Flame, did you have something you wanted to chip in there?
Not on the subject of the many deaths of Lord British, but when you were asking about what are the new incremental or evolutionary changes that Ultima 5 brought to the table...
Totally.
We talked about conversations already, or we talked about schedules and talked to people and indirectly alluded to the fact that their conversations could change depending on time of day, and just in general that they were a lot deeper than Ultima 4's. Ultima 4, it was the rare NPC that responded to more than one or two keywords beyond name, job, health, buy. And also along the lines of schedules, there was, as was mentioned but not directly brought up in this context, the day-night cycle itself.
True.
I'm not sure how many games were doing that by that point. I know some, Might and Magic 2 had one, it just didn't mean anything. Circles of Magic got added, not just the words, but dividing the spells up into leveled circles. This was the game that introduced that. Or rather, maybe you could say brought it back from Ultima 3, which kind of did it, where each you needed to be a little better with your stat before you could cast the next lettered spell in your section. But 5 is really the one that introduced what a lot of people consider to be one of the hallmarks of the Ultima series. 5 was the one that finally added interactivity with the world.
That's true, too. That was, and that was another thing that we had sketched down on the list, was, you know, the fact that it did, it had... you know, and I mean, ultimately, that was a feature that got enhanced with each additional game. But yeah, this was the first one where you could really, oh, hey, I can see a thing, and I can manipulate it, which did add a ton more depth to the experience of navigating Britannia. Just pause for a minute here, because I see we've had another one join in. I see Gradilla Dragon has just popped in. I hope I didn't butcher that pronunciation too terribly much there, man. Hang on, let me just... hello! If you want to say hi, come on. Uh-oh, we're having some mic difficulties, I think, here. Okay, well, we'll work that out. We got him? Maybe. And then, of course, the size of the world was another big thing that changed within the game, too. I mean, it kind of... They always seem to, you know, find ways to increase the size of the world with each. There we go. I mean, if you want to speak to that, by all means, go ahead.
You say that they increased the size of the world with each game, but for me, 5 was the biggest. It only got smaller after 5.
Absolutely.
And that's primarily a factor of switching from 2-scale to single-scale maps. But 5 not only had the largest Britannia, but it also had the Underworld, which was huge. So, for my money, 5 is the biggest Ultima.
Yeah, and I mean, definitely if you do factor in the size and scale of the dungeons, I think 5 easily comes away as, you know, probably you're going to explore more there than anywhere.
Not to mention the actual 3D dungeons, unlike Ultima 4, actually contained individual rooms at intersections and such. So there were multiple layers to how it revealed its game world.
Yeah, the dungeons were definitely much more complex. They weren't just, you know, hallways that bent oddly. The dungeons now had, you know, sort of a definite, purposeful design to them that included, as you say, rooms and...
Unless you're Wanderer of the Spies.
Wow, okay, yeah. Yeah, Despise would be the one off there. But then just that whole underworld concept, just even the idea of, you know, this one vast dungeon underpinning the entirety of the world. I don't think it's been attempted in too many games that have followed. I mean, certainly the idea appears often enough in, you know, fantasy fiction. Dungeons and Dragons, you know, for example, certainly has the, what do they call it? The Underdark, I think, is the one that pops up in, like, the Forgotten Realms setting, at least. But I can't think of too many other games that have really... dived in and attempted to implement something like this grand continent-spanning mega dungeon that exists under all of the other smaller dungeons that you know the land is built upon or the land is peppered with. If I'm wrong, please cite me a title. I'd actually care to check that out.
Well, I could be wrong about this, but I think the Underworld was actually the same size as far as its dimensions and tiles as the Overworld. Was that the case? Okay. It's almost like the oceans became mountains. To block you in.
Yeah, it's a complete second map. Game.
Yeah, it is a totally separate map. Golden Flame just shot something out in chat there regarding the Zine games, and I'm trying to...
The Might and Magic...
Maybe some of the Might and Magics. I mean, the Zine games were kind of weird in that I don't recall there being a dungeon that kind of joined all the other dungeons together. But the Zine games were kind of weird in that, you know, you had certain dungeons that would lead if you had both Zine games co-installed. I mean, nowadays it's trivial. You go to GOG and get World of Zine, and that's got 4 and 5. But, you know, I remember, like, buying 4... and then saving up my allowance for a while, and then buying 5 later. And, you know, so I'd been playing 4 for a while, and then I got 5, and I co-installed it with 4, and that was actually a little bit tricky under DOS to actually make that work properly. But then, yeah, if you, you know, as I kept playing through 4, there were certain dungeons where, yeah, if you went all the way to the bottom, you came out... on the other side of the world. Of course, the world within the Zine mythos was a flat disk, right? It was just a flat, rectangular disk. A planet seed, if you will, within the larger mythology of the series. So, you know, that worked. Not really the same as an underworld, because, you know, here was the other side of the disk. It still had a sky, it still had, you know, plants, trees, towns, everything. Although it was the dark side of the disc, you know, it was only one side that was really sun-facing. And I'm trying to think, was there a day-night cycle in that game? I'm having a hard time recalling now. Ah.
I never actually played them. I just knew that they had the double-sided feature, so...
Yeah, and I mean, you know, to be fair, that was actually a really cool thing, and I would love to see some other developer, you know, take on the challenge of releasing a game and then months later releasing... a game that was both totally playable as a standalone title, but also a complete expansion to both the story and world of the predecessor game. I can't think of any other series that has attempted that.
There was some very brief discussion on the Ultima Codex about Underworld Ascendant and Shroud of the Avatar when news first broke that there was going to be some sort of connection between the two, that they may have in fact been planning to do that. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be the case.
Yeah, it did. It was briefly exciting, but it seems more that the sharing there will be on the level of, you know, story and lore. It's not like I don't even know if we'd be able to move characters between the games. Although, who knows? It's early still. All right. What else did we mention here? Someone put on the list simplification of classes.
Yeah.
I want to speak to that a little bit there.
Well, just one of the things that stands out to me in Ultima 5 versus other RPGs, and I don't play so much of 4, but gathering from, you know, some of the books that have come out and just playing other games and tabletop games, is that the class system is really simple compared to those other games. It's broken down just to, you know, you've got your fighter, your thief type character, and your mage.
They may have reduced it instead of having 8 classes for the 8 virtues to 3 classes for the 3 principles.
That makes sense.
Go on.
It was, it felt a little bit ripped off, actually, because in the Book of Lore, you read that opening story of how Lord Burdish came to Sosaria and he met Shamino, and Shamino hurts himself, but then casts Manny on himself. Well, in Ultima 5, Shamino isn't casting any spells because he's a fighter.
Yeah, they did kind of bump the companions between classes a bit there, too, and that was always a weird one of Shamino, the ranger, who is now a fighter.
Becoming one of the biggest badasses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I shall humbly pound you into the dirt. But, you know, too, like, I wonder if a lot of that maybe came about for technical reasons, too. Like, I can remember talking with Bill Randolph, and this about Ultima 9, but, you know, throughout the course of that development, and throughout the course of, you know, the discussion I had with him, he kept talking about how their biggest hurdle was the fact that they were always having to trade off, or always having to, you know, sort of deal with this tension between the features that they wanted to include and the variables and information that they were able to actually support within the object model, within the Windows environment that they were working in at the time. And, you know, so he mentioned that, you know, even something like, you know, object persistence, right? You know, like if I walk up to one of the barrels in the game and I smash it, well, now I've created a really big problem for the programmers because I've taken one 3D object and I've turned it into about 4, okay? And then I decide to be a real jerk and I take each of those 4 pieces and I move them around, okay? So now I've turned one 3D object into 4, I've moved them around, so the game now has to keep track of 4 times the number of 3D objects that it had to keep track of previously, save their state, save their positions, make sure that if I come back to that area, I still see the pieces of barrel that I'm expecting to see there. You know, like, that took a lot for them to implement, and, you know, as a result, they didn't necessarily have the ability to save, you know, other pieces of the world state that would be necessary to allow for NPC schedules, right? And, I mean, you know, that was on 1999 level hardware. I can only imagine that adding something as complex as day-night cycles and NPC scheduling logic in the late 80s probably severely limited other aspects of Ultima 5's development.
Yeah, it's a shame that when 3D was in its infancy that they didn't realize that the depth of mechanics and the complexity of the game that they'd created, you know, really up till Ultima 7, that they were just, you know, going to be unable to translate that same level of detail into 3D. Because what they ended up doing by moving to 3D was actually, as you mentioned, sacrificing those elements, which is a shame, because for me, that's really what Ultima is about.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So I do want to kind of keep this moving along. So brief discussion of, I guess, the feelies that were included in the Ultima 5 game box. Any thoughts there?
Well,
I never had a box copy of Ultima 5.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I, as we all grab our boxes, I mentioned the journal, you know, accounting of Lord British's disappearance into the underworld because your discussion a few episodes ago with yourself about maps and game maps made me think of this as it's another kind of map. You're following these instructions landmark by landmark into the underworld, and you can see it. Now, oh, there are those mountains. There are the rapids. Oh, I have to portage around this waterfall, which, of course, was really cool, and we all loved doing that. So it just, yeah, that made me think of your map discussion.
Yeah, that was... Well, I mean, again, I only ever had the... That was a game that I played when I got the Ultima Collection. It was not something I had the chance to explore directly. But you know, it's interesting because, you know, that's kind of true of a lot of the Ultima box content. And this even up as far as 9, like the entirety of the series more or less offered this. You know, everything that was included, the maps, the manuals, everything was built to, yeah, draw you into the narrative. And not only draw you into the narrative of the game, but also flesh out the larger lore of the land that you were entering into. And almost always it did this marvelously. Right. What else do we got? Oh, yeah. we were mentioning Katrina the Tank, and, you know, on a not entirely unrelated note, how about that magic axe in the game?
Love it and hate it.
Yeah, in many ways it detracted from it, because it got to a point... sort of like the Chrysogram and Symphony of the Night, if anyone's familiar with that. The weapon is so glorious and so effective that it almost cheapens the game. It's almost like you've just enabled a cheat feature. And it just really lessens the impact of what you're doing. Certainly makes the game easier.
But in a day before the internet, before everybody just knew that there was a magic axe in a tree in Jhelum, finding it for the first time, because I did play 5 when it first came out on the Commodore, finding it for the first time was really one of the bigger, oh, okay, moments of just the world exploration and interactivity.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, again, you know, something that definitely we now think of as a hallmark of the Ultima games. Almost an analog, although the musket in Ultima 7 was nowhere near this overpowered, but it's almost an analog to that, right? Because, you know, there's like, I think, 2 muskets in the game and maybe 100 bullets around the land. Although I think you can make more. I can't remember what you do to make more, but I think there's a way. But, you know, it's like there's some in the storeroom in Britain, and then actually, funnily enough, around Jhelum again. If you go sailing or carpeting around the islands there's a hidden passageway in the mountains, and you walk through it and you find like this old pirate's hideout, and there's a musket and some more ammo in there.
The magic axe had the effect on me as soon as I picked up Ultima 6, I immediately, you know, okay, where's the magic axe? How can I make a magic axe?
yeah, no, nothing quite so overpowered in Ultima 6, that I can think of. The halberd was kind of a wicked weapon to wield if you had that. You could do a ton of damage with that. All right, well, let's move on here a little bit and talk about the gameplay of Ultima 5. So, what are some of the different gameplay approaches that Ultima 5 allows for? I mean, obviously, you know, you can just play it straight with, you know, a party. You can collect your, you know, the usual party that you, of companions that we all know and love so well.
yeah, and of course there's the single, which, you know, famously John Miles beat Richard Garriott in that first playthrough by doing that.
Right.
It's a quick way to get to level 8.
Yeah, I suppose it would be. Now, I forget. Well, you start solo. So you just, yeah, you start solo in the game, so you don't have to recruit people, right?
Well, you start with Shamino and Yolo
at Yolo's cottage, and Shamino is pretty battered.
Right. But you can tell them to leave off and, you know, leave
you
alone,
you can drop
right?
them off at the nearest inn, and I'm pretty sure there's one in you, so.
Mm-hmm. See, again, like, I've got the Ultima 6 framework, where it's just, you know, if you actually tell Dupre, Shamino, and Yolo to leave the party, they're just like, no, King's orders.
Yeah, in 5 you can't swap the party around entirely, but you do have to wait until you get to an inn to ditch anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas in 6, to solo it, you have to murder your dearest friends. Anyway. Yeah, and of course, you know, and this was funny. I was, I don't know if you were online just at the time, but just before we started the broadcast, Don, I was talking about an article at Kotaku that might serve as a template for a future podcast.
Yes, I was.
Which was, you know, okay, yeah, you were there. So, you know, the concept of, you know, in Kotaku's sense, you know, they said really role play. So, you know, like actually like play as your character in the world. And is that what you meant here by themed gameplay?
Well, that's one version of it. I've definitely played through where, you know, well, what would this, knowing the personalities of the characters, oh, what would they like? You know, maybe they wouldn't pick up this armor. They'd stick with their leather and they'd pick up this weapon and influence the avatar to, oh, let's go to this town next, or that kind of thing. The other thing I meant by themed gameplay is sometimes I've decided I'm just going to have all mages. We're just going to be magic badasses and try and beat the game that way.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would kind of make it fun. And linguistic, I suppose you're doing another sort of take on that, right? Because, you know, you're playing through the Ultimas as though it's the same character each time. So I've, you know, I mean, I recall that you had a very unfortunate saunter through you in Ultima 3, was it?
Yes, yes, I had
and then when you got to writing about Ultima 4,
I did a lot of my grinding in 3 by going on a rampage on the clerics and you, and avoided it for quite a while when I started up Ultima 4, which was kind of difficult because I did that as a druid. But yeah, that's how I've been approaching my playthroughs on the blog, kind of keeping in mind, because I'm trying to focus on the narrative as a whole for the blog, and as a result, I've kind of played through the games with that always in the back of my head, trying to make my decisions on where to go and how the character acts in regard to past actions and how he's developed, quote unquote, as I made my way through the series.
It would be interesting to see something like your playthrough where you're actually trying to act as though the avatar, you know, and his party members, his friends, would in fact act within the confines of the narrative. It'd be interesting to see something like that converted into a series, like a television series on HBO. You know, to actually watch that drama play out, that'd be pretty incredible.
Game of Ultima?
There you go.
Game of Virtues.
Yes.
Ah, there you go. There you go.
Either you win or you lie.
Yeah, I've never played an Ultima game actually trying to roleplay, you know, the various characters, but you know, tangential to the gameplay, I'd like to get back to, you know, some of the actual mechanics of the game that I think at the time were just absolutely revolutionary that I'd never seen or heard of that other games had tried to implement. You know, as we mentioned before, we have the day-night cycles, we have the NPC schedules. But for me, in many ways, and to a degree, Ultima was like this all the way from the very first one. Ultima was the first Grand Theft Auto, and that it was open world. It didn't stop you from killing the good guys. You know, you could rob, steal, pillage, go wherever you wanted. It didn't really have a heavy hand as far as guiding you or limiting your movement. And I'd never seen really the level of detail that they put into that philosophy in other games. For example, I think the real crowning achievement as far as what was just fun in Ultima 5 was to go climb up, you know, on top of the castles, and walk amongst the crenellations and fire cannons. You could incite the guards to attack you, to follow you up. You could push the cannon, you know, just push it around the top of the castle and fire it and kill the guards without actually entering into combat proper with them and take care of them. I mean, it must have taken 15 years or, you know, plus until the Assassin's Creed series where you could do anything like fire cannons at people. So that was just absolutely amazing for, what, 1986, 1988 when it came out?
1988.
Okay.
Game's 2 months older than I am.
So the detail level of its mechanics were incredible. Even today, they're still incredible.
That was a good way to grind for equipment in Ultima 6 as well. Go to Trinzic and just reorient a couple of the cannons and fire them at the guards patrolling the entrances. Yeah, me too. Me too, Golden Flame. Me too. My goodness. All right, so what else do we talk... Oh, yeah, cheats. What sort of cheats, secrets, or exploitable bugs exist in the game? I'm trying to think here. Well, you know what? We don't even need to... Oh, is that you, Gridia?
Yeah.
Awesome. Excellent. We have microphone. So, reintroducing, is it... Would it be Gridilla, or would Gridia be a bit more correct as a pronunciation there?
It is Gradilla.
All right. So we are joined by Gradia Dragon as well. Popped in a little bit earlier and then immediately went on a quest to rid his microphone equipment of Shadow Lords.
I had to bring it back from the dead.
From the underworld.
In Monty Corp.
Exactly. Wait, no, that's Create Food.
No, that's In Monty Lem.
Oh, right, In Monty Lem, that's right. In Monty Corp would be yes. Ah, my goodness, I'm rusty on this stuff. All right, cheating in Ultima 5. Well, our friends at the wiki have a few things they mention here.
so, flip-flop. Yes.
Flip-flop?
Tile swapping.
Flip-flop. If you yelled flip-flop in the Commodore version, I don't know if it was in any of the others, but if you yelled flip-flop, it mirror-imaged the screen vertically. Everything was upside down.
Oh, really? That's,
Made no
thing.
Change in the actual gameplay or anything. It was just there. I don't know. It would do the little earthquake effect, and then it would swap everything.
Well, they don't list that under the cheats, but there are a few Commodore 64 specific cheats, like how to create more reagents using... this is fun. If you have between 11 and 15 of some reagents, and then mix a spell using only those reagents, and mix 16 of the spell, because I guess you could specify a quantity, you should get 16 of the spell and 90 plus of each of the reagents. It's clearly a math bug there.
Man, I wish I'd known that one.
Yeah. In the pub in Empath Abbey, evidently the other people's stuff tag is not attached to most of the provisions there. And then, worse, you can climb up and down the ladder to cause the food to reappear. So you can basically just spam the Empath Abbey pub, and this in the Commodore 64 version only, evidently, to get tons and tons of food. Which would be pretty valuable in the game, because, you know, I mean... This was Doug's playthrough of Lazarus, but, you know, if you recall Doug the Eagle Dragon's attempt to play through Ultima 5 Lazarus, he basically cast food as, you know, this horrible narcotic that was just everybody in Britannia was addicted to, and the side effects of going cold turkey were sudden and immediate painful death. So it was... Yeah, I am actually genuinely glad that the food mechanic was lessened in some of the Ultimas. It's back in a little bit of a way in Ultima 7, and I forget how annoying the party can be when they start getting hungry. But
yeah, just briefly back to some of the improvements from previous Ultimas. One of the things that was always just a terrible grind and concern that was absolutely no fun in earlier Ultimas was trying to manage food. You're always running out of food. To a degree, that was replaced by managing torches in Ultima 5 when you went to the underworld. Because if you couldn't see if you ran out of torches down there, it was pretty much game over. But it was so much easier to get food because, unlike in the previous ones, when you attacked enemies, you would get so much more loot. So you were always getting stuff, even stuff you didn't need, you could sell. So having gold to buy basics like food was never really a problem in 5, where it had always been before.
Yeah. I mean, again, it was a surprise to me because, you know, I came from 6, where, you know, food was important to have for the campfires at the end of the day. I think it impacted how much you healed when you rested. But, you know, it was never a thing where, like, you know, you need it constantly just to navigate Britannia. You know, if your party went hungry one night, it wasn't the end of the world. All right. Moving on. What are some of the more mysterious aspects of Ultima 5? And we've got two here. One is the Ankh, and the other one is the Arm of Turning.
Amulet.
I hope I have that right. Oh, Amulet of Turning, of course. I'm going to write that out right now.
What do they do? The Ankh must do something, because you can get a second one.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Ankh in Ultima 6 was purely decorative. It didn't mean a darn thing. It could well be. I mean, you know, that was the other thing, in that not everything in Ultima necessarily had a purpose, right?
That's what I thought, but if you dig down in the temple and coves in Cove, you can actually unearth a second Ankh. So I thought, well, it must be useful in some way.
Maybe. I honestly can't think of what the use is. I mean, like I say, there's... It's the Ankh in Ultima 6. It's a rare item. It's what you start with, I believe. I think you have the only one. I don't know if there's a second one to be found anywhere. And it's purely decorative as a necklace. It does nothing.
Who here is actually...
Tonics and pants.
Who here is actually defeated or won Ultima 5? Because I got reasonably close. Okay, Adam, did the Ankh, in fact, have anything to do with some of the later mechanics as far as what items do I need to have equipped in order to progress the end-game mechanics?
In fact, you have to take off the Ankh to put on Lord British's amulet to progress. Take that how you will. But you needed Lord British's amulet to find Doom at the very end.
It may have been there simply to represent perhaps the physical Ankh that you received in Ultima 5. Just something the Avatar would naturally wear.
Well, the Ankh became the symbol of the Avatar, and it's interesting that, you know, the Ankh is one of the few possessions that actually bridges, that is actually able to move with the player between Britannia and Earth. You know, like, because the understanding, at least in 5 and 6, is that it's something you bring with you, right? Like, it's like the one possession that actually... also comes through.
Well, it also comes up again in Ultima 4. That's what first comes through the Moon Gate, along with the Book of History and the Book of Magic in the opening sequence. And it's also the only thing you bring back with you in the ending sequence.
Except for your clothes.
Well, yeah, of course.
Well,
it'll be like the Terminator. Every time the Avatar goes through the Moon Gate, lightning flies around him and he's buck naked.
Well, so that's the Jim Cameron remake, then, is what we're going for there. Okay.
I'm pretty sure somebody's written that fanfic, but I haven't read it.
Rule 34. Darn you, Rule 34. Okay. Well, we're coming up on the hour mark, so let's just turn the discussion over to, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit here and there already, but let's turn the discussion over to the legacy of Ultima 5. And we've talked about this one a little bit, but, you know, the one good question is, how did Ultima 5 contribute to the larger
mythos? Oh boy, do I have a lot to say on that.
Okay.
Let's see, where do I start? Well, for one thing, this is the first game that really makes a big deal of Runic. They come up in Ultima 4 as the visions that you get from Enlightenment at the Shrines, but that's pretty much all you see of it. Whereas in Ultima 5, Runic is everywhere. Pretty much all the street signs are in Runic, all the gravestones are in Runic. In fact, I laughed for about a solid minute when I found one in Sutek's, out by Sutek's place, that reads, "Here lies Richard, buried alive, trying to finish Ultima 5." But it also kind of establishes some thematic elements that are prevalent through the rest of the series. Like, for one thing, it's the middle volume of the Age of Enlightenment trilogy, and the middle volume is always when things take a turn for the darker. And it definitely does in Ultima 5, and it kind of shows the need for nuance of the virtues, that it's not always something starkly black and white. It's not always something easy to interpret in every situation, which is kind of what 5 is about and 6 builds on. In the same sense, it kind of establishes the Avatar's role in Britannia, because Lord British, who is presumably the most powerful one in Britannia itself, can't rescue himself. You've got to go in and get him out of there. It's you who has to solve the problem, which is the case in 6, the case in 7, and is kind of what 9 goes against, ultimately. It's Britannia standing up for itself without the Avatar. Last thing I can think of is the continuing of the pattern that you don't necessarily solve the problem by beating the big bad like you did in the first 3 games. There is no big bad in Ultima 4. You solve Ultima 6 using the diplomatic route, and Ultima 5, you defeat the Shadow Lords, but it's Lord British who ultimately deals with Blackthorn, who is kind of felt to be the other overarching presence besides the Shadow Lords themselves.
Yeah, very true. And I mean, that is actually kind of largely true of the of all 3 of the Age of Enlightenment games, is the fact that, you know, they're not boss battle type games really by any means. I mean, sure, the Shadow Lords, they're kind of pains in the butt to defeat. but you don't... You're right. I mean, when you come to the actual end of the game, it's not like, you know, you have to fight Blackthorn and defeat him. It's, you know, it's you free Lord British, and that's where the solution to that particular problem comes from. And then, of course, I mean, yeah, the it's actually kind of funny, you know, you mentioned Ultima 9, because in some of the various little discards and bits and pieces of the plot documents, like, I think at one point, you know, the Surgorn Dragon knows this one really, really well, and I can never really remember it, but there was always supposed to be, like, some tie between the Shadow Lords and the Guardian as well. Obviously, it was never explored in the final plot, but... but yeah, I guess Ultima 5 kind of very quickly sort of sets you into the, okay, here's how it's going to be for now. Oh, and now everything changes. You know, you go right from Ultima 4's establishment of so much of what Britannia is and what the virtues are, and then Ultima 5 just, like, immediately flips the table over. And then the other Ultima games that kind of follow on interact with the virtues to greater or lesser degrees from there. Now, here's another one. Are there any games that seem, or maybe very obviously are, inspired by Ultima 5?
Tough Dark question.
All right. Okay. I'll go with that.
The Adventure Construction Set that came out for Apple and Commodore back at the time was pretty much literally just here, build an Ultima 4/5.
Really?
Yeah. And then it has been remade more modernly as the Adventure Construction Kit.
Yeah, they also had that for DOS. I actually played with that quite a bit, and you're right. It was basically like you were building an Ultima game. But I think in many ways, you know, the influences of Ultima 5 haven't really begun to be felt until more recently. You know, now with the weakening importance of major publishers and, you know, corporate financial backing of projects, instead of them being risk averse, you know, and coming out with the next Call of Duty, now a lot of games have a different venue where they can self-fund or crowdfund through Indiegogo or Kickstarter, and you're seeing a lot of projects, you know, that harken back to the older days where you do see a lot of experimental mechanics like Ultima 5 had, things that a normal developer wouldn't waste their time doing because they don't see it as necessary to making money. So, like Crowfall, Underworld Ascendant, all these new Ultima-likes that are coming out now, I think, are really striving for the spirit of the mechanics that we saw in Ultima 5.
Yeah, I'm not sure, like, for modern games, it's really hard to say anything from the last, you know, decade and a half, this was inspired by Ultima 5.
Not directly, you know? Perhaps,
any,
right.
Any game like Skyrim, obviously you can trace its descent back to Ultima, but not so much to a specific Ultima.
Right.
You know?
True.
The stuff that it's got introduced between 5 and 7, it harvested from. But as far as saying, like, what games were specifically influenced by Ultima 5 itself, there were a bunch of, like, you know, C-list, let's make a tile-based game that looks like Ultima and possibly just steals their graphics published by who knows. I don't even know what most of them are. I just, every now and then, somebody finds another one and posts about it to the Facebook group.
Yeah. That's very true. I don't know that any of these developers would specifically credit Ultima 5 as an inspiration for their design decisions or their mechanics, but Ultima 5 for me was really the foundation for those type of simulation mechanics, where so much attention was paid to something that most developers or designers would consider an unnecessary detail, a toy. Basically. So I think it really started with Ultima 5, and then of course it continued all the way up to Ultima 7. And so it was the first for me that really tried to go there.
I mean, I guess, and I'm only mentioning this because, you know, Ian Fraser, you know, obviously was the project lead for Ultima 5. Lazarus obviously thinks very highly of Ultima 5. And the only thing I can even think of in terms of like modern AAA type games is, you know, and I'm going to mention Reckoning again. So for those of you who are playing that particular drinking game, take a shot. But you know, there's a little bit of that thematic in Reckoning of, you know, you have this throughout most of the narrative, you're told that, you know, the character of Gadflo, who's the king of the Winter Fae, has gone mad. He's the Mad King, and he, by his own design, has unleashed the Winter Fae and the terror and slaughter that they bring on to the land of Amalur. Close your ears if you don't like spoilers. What you find at the very end of the game is that this is not the case. There is a different entity, who has, in fact, gotten complete hold of Gadflo's mind and is essentially just using him as a puppet to visit this horrible slaughter on the land in advance of her own arrival into it. So, I don't know if Ian had any say into that part of the plot. I mean, I know a lot of it was written by R.A. Salvatore, but he did sneak the occasional bit of
another that kind of plot. Like, for example, Castlevania Symphony of the Night. You fight Richter Belmont, and he's being mind-controlled, and he is working for resurrecting Dracula. And then you have to figure out and defeat the one controlling him, which is a priest Shaft, I think is the name.
Okay. I'm totally unfamiliar with Castlevania.
Well, one of the things about Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which on the surface you would think was completely unrelated to Ultimate, actually, it turns the tables. Traditionally, you're Richter Belmont or vampire hunter, a human trying to kill, you know, Dracula, the vampires. In Symphony of the Night, you're actually Dracula's son, a hybrid human vampire, who is in fact trying to stop, if not kill, his father. Similar to how in Ultima 5, the tables are turned. Suddenly, the Avatar, who was previously a hero, you know, celebrated, is now an outlaw. You know, and, you know, the system that supported him before has now turned against him, including some of the citizens of the game. So, in that respect, I think it's actually an interesting analogy. By the way, if anyone has not played Symphony of the Night, that arguably is the finest platformer RPG hybrid ever made. Just an excellent game in every way. And you should not die without having played it.
Duly noted, I'll find a system that supports it.
From the Journal of the Avatar, from the period of history known as the Warriors of Destiny. Day 24 of the 8th month, 189th year of the Britannian calendar. 3 days. That was how long it had been since we'd last seen the sun. It half blinded us as we emerged from the prison caverns of Wrong and made us trip and stumble over the rocky coast of Lost Hope Bay. Yet even so, we were glad for its presence. The aches of the travel-weary, the wounds of battle, they can be soothed by rest or by magic. But there is no balm for the palpably oppressive gloom of the underworld, except to escape from it. And between Dupre sliding halfway down an underground mountain amid the cacophony of the rockfall clanging against his armor, and a hallway of explosive traps culminating in a fight with 4 demons, that had been no easy task. Yet escape we had, with the shard of hatred nestled in my pack, and it was a relief. The 6 of us each found a perch, taking a moment to catch our breath now that we were back on the surface. The lapping of the waves against the rocks, the steady rise and fall, was soothing. The only sounds of running water in the underworld were the roars of waterfalls, echoing off the cavern walls. The light fluttering of wings had me tense for a moment, until I heard the call that accompanied it, and relaxed, reminding myself the sound no longer meant the approach of yet another pack of mong bats and the inevitable fight they brought with them, but that of harmless gulls, or perhaps even an albatross. Compared to the dank and dismal place we had just come out of, this was pure tranquility. But as much as I wanted to sit and savor the scenery, there was still work to be done, and my desire to see it finished won out. Reluctantly, I rose. "We've still a job to do," I told the others. "We make for the Abbey." And one by one, they rose as well, without complaint. Long as it was, the walk through the deep forest was refreshing in a way. Though the thick canopy filtered the sunlight, it was still brighter than the torches we were forced to make use of in the underworld. And better still, instead of seeing little more than the inky black beyond the glow of the torch, here in the forest, we were treated to a display of nearly every shade of green imaginable. Shamina was certainly in better spirits because of it, humming a jaunty, though slightly off-key, tune as we walked. Yolo only just managed to hold back a grimace, though not well enough to keep from amusing Yana in the process. The snap of twigs beneath our boots, the twitter of the sparrows in the trees, the rustle of the leaves as a squirrel darted along a branch, they were far more comfortable noises than the reverberations of the caverns. Still, as we neared the keep, my unease grew bit by bit. I remembered well the encounters I had in the Lyceum and Serpent's Hold. How could I possibly forget them? The whispered lies with just enough truth to make them believable that filled my head in Faulenay's presence. The crippling fear that came from Nosventor's approach. That fear that had come far too close to overtaking me. Though the Shadow Lords could be banished and defeated, it was not so easy to do the same with the vices they stood for. At least this one would be the last. The towering trees thinned eventually, traded for the crenellated stone towers of Empath Abbey. We wound our way around the greenery and merrily bubbling marble fountains of the courtyard through the expansive archway on its eastern side. Ascending the stairwell there, we walked down the wide, inviting hallways until we arrived at the alcove where the flame of love was kept. Barbara, the flame's keeper, curtsied as we entered, and I bowed slightly in return. "Clear the room, if you would," I told her, "and I think it would be best if you made sure none enter until we emerge again." If Lord Michael spoke the truth, then those living in the keep had never felt the effects a Shadow Lord could have on their mind when encountered face to face. I wanted to keep it that way if I was able. Barbara asked no questions on the matter, just curtsied once more, replying, "As my lord requests." She walked out of the room, shutting the solid oaken door behind her, and that was that. I turned to the flame, watching it crackle and dance. Not the cool blue of the flame of truth, nor the brilliant red of the flame of courage, but a soft, pleasing yellow. Then I cast my gaze upward. The room, unlike the others, was left open to the air, and I wondered briefly what might happen if it rained. I shook the thought from my mind, taking out the shard. This was no time to get distracted by idle musings. I took a few breaths to steady myself, then called out clear and loud, Astaroth! The name rent the air, echoing off the walls before the darkness descended, and I'm still not certain I didn't hear a thunderclap, despite a cloudless sky. The shadows deepened, thickened, drew themselves together into the form of the Shadow Lord I had just named, glowing red eyes deep in a face hidden by a cowl, and I was no longer in the Abbey. Instead, I was thrown into the midst of vivid memory. A father's whimpers, begging for mercy from anyone who passed by, slammed into the stocks for simply not giving enough to the poor, and that mercy not for himself, but for his child, who shared the same fate for neglecting to turn in his own father. A man rattling his chains behind bars, cruelly imprisoned, desperate for news of the boy he'd been torn away from, hope fading with each passing day. Blackthorn's dungeons catching glimpses of the instruments of torture kept there, the frenzied cries of their victims thrashing against the unforgiving iron restraints still hanging in the air. Shamino, glowing bolt driven deep into his chest, struggling for each raspy breath even as they intertwined with barely suppressed groans of pain, not knowing whether they were his last. The faces of dozens upon dozens injured in some way or another by what the shadow before me had wrought. And my hatred burned. An absolutely murderous scream tore from my throat, piercing the illusion, and I lunged, wanting to rip, to tear, to destroy, to kill, only to find my shoulders gripped by Dupre on one side and Yolo on the other, restraining me, and my axe in one hand. I hadn't recalled it being there before. Past grievances drifted through my head, magnified into full-out rage, tempting me to fight against my own companions, that seething hate still bubbling beneath the surface, demanding I turn it on those who would dare hold me back. Swallowing hard, and with great effort, I shoved those temptations aside, casting the shard where it clattered into the brazier. The flame burned brighter, grew larger, and the calm, steady glow became a full-out blaze, roaring as it caught the Shadow Lord's cloak, consuming Astaroth, who protested the inevitable with an unearthly shriek that splintered the clashing light and darkness into 1,000 pieces. And then it was silent. Nobody breathed for the space of a few beats. And then John's voice. It is done then. I turned to face him, and nodded once, enough of a pause to steady my own voice. It is done.
If you want to join the Ultima Dragons, you can do so at udic.org, where you can choose your very own dragon name. You can also find the Ultima Dragons on Facebook. We have a Facebook group there. And you can follow at Ultima Dragons on Twitter or join them on Discord. And if you're feeling really old school, you can even fire up a Telnet client and check out the Wearmount. Hit up the show notes for links to all of these. If you want to participate more directly in the podcast, you can send us an email. Or if you're feeling a little bit braver, leave us a voice message in one of three places: the podcast website, our Facebook page, or on anchor.fm. And you're also welcome to join us on our Discord server to chat with us, to lurk, or even contribute to podcast recordings when they happen. And again, links in the show notes. If you'd like to support Spam 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 Humbug, you can do so at patreon.com/ultimacodex, where for as little as $1 a month, you can get access to episodes the day before they go live to the general public. You'll also get access to behind-the-scenes audio when we have some to share, and possibly other interesting content. but we also welcome your moral support. You can like the Ultima series on Facebook, follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter, or leave the podcast a review on iTunes. And you're also welcome to share our episodes with your friends and social media circles. Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is a production of the Ultima Codex. You can find show notes online at spamspamspamhumbug.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be virtuous.